Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a decision by the DC Court of Appeals that broke with 150 years of precedent striking down President Obama's use of recess appointments. Azeez Haque, Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, joins us to discuss this radical decision in the context of the growing rightward tilt of our judiciary from successful efforts by Republicans to filibuster Democratic nominees to the federal bench. On top of using legislative trickery to hobble federal agencies Republicans don't like, this latest display of conservative judicial activism now prevents a Democratic president from getting around Republican roadblocks. Then we'll look into filibuster reform that appears to have fizzled in the Senate, where a watered-down version has been agreed to. We will look into what kind of reform can be expected and what more could have been achieved, with a veteran of the Senate, Ira Shapiro, who was counsel to the majority leader of the U.S. Senate. We will discuss the enormous backlog of bills and appointments created by the unprecedented use of the filibuster by Republicans and how much these reforms will unblock the Senate. Then finally, we will examine the U.S.'s increased reliance on drones and recent efforts by the U.N. to launch an inquiry into the proliferation of drones now used by 51 countries and the lack of a legal framework of international law to deal with this new weapon. Richard Rubenstein, the University Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University, joins us. He is the author of Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. Joining us now is Azeez Haque, who is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Supreme Court and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Azeez Haque, welcome to Background Briefing.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me on the show.
And this break with 150 years of precedent that's just taken place with the decision by the D.C. Court of Appeals who have struck down the use of recess appointments in relation to the National Labor Relations Board and the new Consumer Protection Agency. First of all, given the work that you've done on unchecked and unbalanced presidential powers in a time of terror, there is obviously a striking irony here that conservative justices seem to bend over backwards to give president the power to use drones, to use Guantanamo, and to have limited powers, if you will, in terms of even killing U.S. citizens. But at the same time, they seem to be taking away at least this president's power to do recess appointments, which, again, is 150 years of precedent out the window.
I think you're absolutely right to say there's an irony. The decision last week turned on exactly when the Senate is in recess. And the court, the D.C. Circuit, took a very narrow view of what constitutes a recess adequate for the triggering of the president's constitutional power to make appointments in during a recess. There is a long history, as many people have noted in response to the decision, of presidents making recess appointments, and it's certainly not clear that that power has, as a historical matter, been limited to instances in which the Senate is absolutely and entirely out of session, as opposed to in some sort of hiatus within the session. And that's what's at issue here. And the aggressive reading of the recess power appointment against the president is, as you say, ironic, coming from a court, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the intermediate court that sits in Washington, D.C., and that hears a lot of cases about federal regulatory policy. This is a court that is known to be quite conservative. It has some very well-known conservative judges on its bench, including Judge David Santel, who was the author of last week's decision in respect to the NLRB.
But again, back to the broader issue of the unlevel playing field, the extent to which Republicans have used the filibuster to prevent Democrats from appointing judges to the federal bench. And nobody has more of a backlog than President Obama, from my understanding. He's way down compared to previous presidents in the number of of appointees he's managed to get on the judiciary. So you have this situation where the Republicans have created the roadblocks, and then now they've found a way to create another roadblock, which is meant to get around the first roadblock.
Well, this decision is really important with respect to federal agencies like the National Labor Relations Board and the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which you mentioned, where the Senate, and in particular the Republican minority in the Senate, has used the filibuster power. It's also used the power of individual senators to place holds on individual nominees to block up regulatory appointments. And this is important because there are many agencies where the agency isn't able to engage in regulation if it doesn't have a leader, a head. This is true of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which Richard Corduroy is currently a recess appointee to. It's true of the NLRB and the labor unit. And so the effect of this decision, in tandem with the Republican minorities' use of both the filibuster and the hold power, is to block up the ability of regulatory agencies that deal with consumer finance, that deal with labor relations, that deal with the environment, to get anything done. So the overall effect of this decision is really important with respect to the regulatory state, the ability of President Obama and his agencies below him to impose regulations on business in particular. So the decision is really in keeping with a deregulatory tilt that we've seen over many years on the part of the D.C. Circuit. The decision, I think, is not as important with respect to federal judges. There are instances in which federal judges have been appointed through recess appointees, but no one thinks that recess appointees are a long-term solution to the now 100-plus vacancies that are on the federal bench, and as you say, the sort of asymmetrical limit on Obama in getting his nominees on the bench as opposed to earlier presidents such as President Bush.
But aren't there judicial appointees that have been nominated to the D.C. Circuit Court, which would balance it a little, that have been blocked by filibusters?
Absolutely. The most important of these is a woman called Caitlin Flanagan, who was the Solicitor General of New York State. And she has been filibustered by the Republicans, including members of the Republican Party who were members of the Gang of 14. If you cast your mind back a few years, there was a deal made within the Senate not to filibuster nominations of President Bush. And this was a bipartisan deal, and several of the Republican members of that gang have voted to filibuster a number of President Obama's candidates, including Caitlin Flanagan, including Goodwin Liu, who's a really superb judge who now sits on the California State High Court. And the reasons that are given for these filibusters are, well, you know, these are people who are quote-unquote too extreme, right? And with Flanagan in particular, I think what's driving the opposition is the fact that she, as Solicitor General in New York, had a role on gun regulation policy. And so the NRA in particular has been really vocal in pushing against her nomination. And this is again part of this deregulatory tilt or deregulatory agenda that's going on. The NRA has also been very successful at ensuring that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms does not have a permanent director, right? And without a permanent director, it's hard for it to get things done, right? So I think that the most useful way of thinking about this is this is a decision that, in tandem with what's going on in the courts, in tandem with what's going on in terms of sort of blocking up the Senate, is making it really hard for the president to regulate industry. And so it is benefiting primarily big business at the cost of, and I would include in that gun manufacturers, at the cost of the dispersed public.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Supreme Court and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Now, there's no secret that the Republicans don't like the National Labor Relations Board, and they did everything they could to stop and frustrate the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau from being born, they held up the appointment of a leader to that, Richard Cordray, and so they found another way, it looks like, to get around it, in this case through the judiciary. And the judiciary and Republican political operatives aren't supposed to work hand in hand, but it's starting to look that way. And my question is a broader question about American democracy. We just had a president who won handily, 5 million ahead in the popular vote, enormous victory in the Electoral College. And his agenda is being blocked and stopped. And this has been the case for some time through the use of the filibuster. But now they, on top of the legislative trickery involved in hobbling these agencies, now the courts have handed the Republicans a gift here, and it seems to strike at the heart of democracy that, you know, we elect governments by popular will, and if through all kinds of ruses the opposition can limit this government's ability to govern, then what does that say about our democracy?
Well, I have to be a little careful here, Ian, otherwise you'll accuse me of hypocrisy, because what you're describing is really the operation of our system of fragmented power, our system of checks and balances, where even if you get a thumping majority in the Electoral College, nonetheless, that doesn't mean that your party will prevail in the same way in the House and the Senate, and certainly not in the court. So what we're seeing is really a friction imposed upon policy change by our separation of powers. And sometimes that's a good thing, in my view, and sometimes I think it leads to outcomes that I personally don't like. And I get, you know, I'll put my cards on the table. I don't like the sort of the delay and or the breaking of President Obama's regulatory agenda here. With respect to the courts, both Republicans and Democrats have used the courts as a tool in to advance policy agendas over time, and this was true, for example, in the civil rights era, where the courts were instrumental in pushing against Jim Crow. It was true in the 80s when the courts, increasingly staffed by Republicans, were instrumental in pushing back on the Great Society and other kinds of regulation. It was certainly true in the context of the healthcare decision from last year, where, to pick up on something else you said, the Supreme Court's decision and the way that it talks about the individual mandate in the Health Care Act really picked up on the arguments made by political operatives in the year or two since the health care law was passed. Rather than drawing upon ideas or resources or precedent that were in the constitutional case law, you really saw the conservative members of the court picking up on basically the Tea Party's arguments. And I don't think that there's anything new about the idea that the court the behavior of the court is going to reflect and resonate the behavior of political actors. What I think is new here is that, or what I think is especially striking here is that the Republican Party has been incredibly successful in identifying an ideology that they want in judges, getting getting judges with that ideology appointed, and then banging the drum of judicial activism against views they don't like, and blocking candidates that President Obama has put forward, even when they are, as in I think Flanagan and Liu's case, quite moderate. So it's a stunning piece of hypocrisy and self-serving political framing that I think the Obama administration can be fairly faulted for utterly failing to respond to.
Well, that, I think, is the real question is, Aziz Haq, is I don't know what the figures are, but my understanding is the judiciary, because the Republicans have been so successful at pushing through their nominees, and as you mentioned, the deal that was done a few years back during the Bush administration, no such deal has been done in to accommodate the Democrats or this particular president. He hasn't been able to get hundreds of his nominees for the federal bench are sitting there. So you end up with a highly slanted federal bench that, not surprisingly, comes up with decisions like this decision from the D.C. Circuit Court, which is completely dominated by conservatives because the liberal judges that have been nominated simply don't even get a hearing. So it seems
I think and I think it's slanted, just to pick up on one thing you said, in two really different and important ways. The first thing is that the rate at which Obama has been able to get his nominees appointed has been lower than even during President Bush. I think it's around 75%. So it's not, you know, we're not talking nobody gets nominated. But a lot of that 75% is fairly uncontroversial trial court judges. It's the really controversial Court of Appeals judges who tend to get filibustered or blocked. So that's one thing. Then there's a separate point, which is that if you look at the behavior of Republican-appointed judges, I think it is fair to say that they have been more aggressive and innovative on issues like the First Amendment, on issues like campaign finance reform, on issues like the Second Amendment, on issues like the power of the president, on issues like extirpating the relevance of international law in constraining U.S. Detention policy. Republican judges tend to be innovative and activist, and the Democratic judges who get appointed, I think it is fair to say, are much more moderate, right? So it's not just that there's simply more Republican-appointed than Democrat-appointed judges on the court. I think it is fair to say that the Republican judges have this fighting spirit about them, and the Democrats tend to be, well, rather milquwater.
But that's a result of moving the goalposts to the right, right? If you can only get a judge on the Democratic side, even to a hearing because of Republican pressure, nobody but a milquetoast Democrat's ever going to get that far, right? Isn't that how the system works now?
I think that's absolutely right. But I think that we ought not to omit the White House, the Obama White House, from the responsibility for this situation. I think that if you look at the way that the Obama administration has placed political capital, how it's distributed its political capital, how it has prioritized judges, it has simply not put much heft behind judges, even though there are factions, interest groups within the Democratic Party coalition who care deeply about judges. I mean, look at the activism and interest and passion with respect to the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, right? This is the who judges are matters a great deal. Part of this, I think, goes back to Obama's sort of basic political philosophy as revealed in his two autobiographies, which in those books he says, look, I don't think judges are that important for American social change. Now, there's something to be said for that, but surely if the healthcare debacle, the litigation in the courts, has taught him something, it's got to be that even if federal judges don't drive social and policy change, they sure as heck can stand in its way. And that's right. What's going on, and that's why the appointment process matters.
Well, if you didn't get a wake-up call from the healthcare bill that he thought actually the Supreme Court was going to strike it down, apparently, what just happened to him in terms of recess appointments should certainly get his attention. And I thank you for joining us, Aziz Haq.
No, thank you for having me on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haq. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Supreme Court and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a Senate veteran about what kind of filibuster reform we can expect. Somebody's acting like a child. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ira Shapiro, who's an international trade lawyer in Washington, D.C. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions where he played an important role in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and the completion of the D.C. Metro rail system. During the Clinton administration, he earned the rank of ambassador, serving as the leading U.S. trade negotiator. His new book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ira Shapiro.
It's good to be with you, Ian. Thanks for letting me come on.
And this is in terms of courage and statesmanship in times of crisis. It seems to me that you can make the case that American democracy itself is in a state of crisis. It looks like the Republicans, rather than accept their defeat in the last election, are finding all kinds of ways to get around the demographic problem that they face by gerrymandering, and they're trying at the state level to change the electoral colleges, particularly in the swing state, how the votes are counted and apportioned in a very undemocratic way. And they're also, the previous interview that we did with Aziz Huck, who served on as a clerk on the Supreme Court, about what's just happened with the D.C. Circuit Court in terms of getting taking away the president's ability at recess appointments. As you know, that is one of the few ways he gets around the filibuster, is being able to appoint people when the Senate is in recess, and now they've closed down that option. So it seems to me that we have a real problem here with American democracy.
Well, Ian, I think I share the view. We have a lot of problems with our democracy. Certainly, I was appalled, as you were, by the D.C. Circuit opinion on recess appointments. And I also, you know, remain very troubled by Citizens United and the implications that that has for our system. And I agree that some of the Republicans don't seem to accept the results of elections that they don't win. But I do think the picture is a little more mixed than that. I'm seeing evidence in Washington that many of the Republicans understand the results of the election that just happened and understand that they were defeated and blamed for both extremism and obstruction. So, I mean, we can be more specific as we get into this, but I think that it's a mixed picture. The Republicans are, having lost emphatically, are struggling among themselves to figure out how to deal with it.
Well, then let's talk about how to deal with it in terms of the Senate, in terms of filibuster reform. When after they made their fiscal cliff deal, Harry Reid, the majority leader, said the first thing we're going to do when we resume in the Senate, it'll happen in the first 36 hours, we'll have filibuster reform. Well, we have something, but it's certainly not what some of the younger senators wanted, like Jeff Merkley. So tell us what is in this package of reforms that Harry Reid apparently was able to make a deal with Mitch McConnell.
I think it's a modest but useful package of reforms that'll make the Senate run somewhat more smoothly, particularly in terms of bringing up legislation without filibusters on motions to proceed to take up the legislation. It also speeds up the consideration of executive branch and judicial nominations, although it doesn't foreclose filibusters there. I think several things need to be said about it. One, I would have liked to have gone farther. And I favor some of the things that Senator Merkley and Senator Udall were putting forward in terms of a talking filibuster. But the traffic wouldn't bear it. And by that I mean, despite what people said and despite what Senator Reid said, the notion of changing the Senate rules by majority, simple majority vote, as opposed to the required two-thirds, is something that people look at, they walk up to it, and they never do. It's called the nuclear option for a good reason. it's regarded as something that would really detonate the Senate. And the Democrats would not give Reid the support to do that, and so he didn't do it.
But let's go back, though, to I mean, obviously, our Ira Shapiro, our sort of ideas or understanding of the filibuster probably in many ways started with that movie, Mr. Smith Comes to Washington.
Yeah.
But it used to work that way. And it's only because that in the recent years, the Republicans have just resorted to it at every level. So instead of a majority rule in the United States Senate, you have to have a supermajority to get anything passed. That is new. That is different. So what was wrong with the old system before the Republicans usurped their power?
Well, the old system worked, as far as I'm concerned, well. It protected minority rights, but filibusters were real and they were rare. And it's true that in recent years they've become routine and unreal. People don't have to filibuster. They just indicate their unhappiness with something, and they can trigger a 60-vote requirement and paralyze the place. I think it's an unacceptable situation. But I also think that many of the senators, Democratic and Republican, actually hate what the Senate has become. I think that what Senator Reid was trying to balance was the desire to make changes and yet to do it in a bipartisan way that allows for the possibility that progress will go forward when we start talking about immigration reform. When we start talking about further fiscal steps, gun control, having a fight over the filibuster and trying to impose new rules by majority vote would literally have blown the place apart.
So what you're telling us then, Ira Shapiro, is that a sort of backroom deal was made that, look, we need to get some stuff passed, and let's, you know, have a little bit of cooperation on what we can achieve. But if you go ahead and go to the nuclear option, then we're not going to achieve anything. Is that?
Well, I think that's true, but I don't want to make it sound, I mean, a backroom deal. It was a deal that was made by people who were talking to each other a lot, Democrats and Republicans. Some of the people who were involved in this deal were some of the leading liberal Democrats in the Senate, particularly Carl Levin, Chuck Schumer, Ben Cardin. These are people who are genuine liberals or progressives, but also believe that the only way you can get the Senate to work better is to accomplish things in a bipartisan way. I know it's difficult because the Republican move to the right over the years, the last few years, has been so severe that it's been very hard to get any kind of cooperation. But I think the elections had an effect on that. And so are the polls, where the Republicans recognize that they're being blamed for the obstruction in the country. So I think that I'm more optimistic about the Senate than many of the people who were very discouraged by its record and by this limited filibuster reform.
Again, I'm speaking with Ira Shapiro, who spent 12 years in the United States Senators Council to the Majority Leader. He's the author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Well, not only did the liberal senators that you mentioned on the Democratic side not support the talking filibuster reform from Merkley and Udall. The two California women, Feinstein and Boxer, and Patrick Leahy weren't on board. So it's a little mystifying. Again, I go back to the question of before the Republicans usurped the power of the filibuster and started to do it for every bill that came by, as opposed to what went on for 200 years prior to that. Why can't we go back to the status quo ante before the Republicans usurped it? I mean, what's the difference between what Merkley and Udall wanted and what used to happen?
Well, what used to happen was a certain amount of restraint on filibusters, but there was no rule that required the talking filibuster. That was just the practice that was followed. My guess is that the senators believe that we will see a decreasing use of the filibusters and the tactics that we've seen in the last 2 years. Now, Reid and McConnell have said that they intend to force people who want to filibuster or exert individual holds to come to the floor and explain themselves. They said that was part, an understanding on this was part of the deal. Now, one can be skeptical a little bit about that because they said something like it 2 years ago. And so I understand why Senators Merkley and Udall and others who support them would be skeptical. But I do think that the atmosphere has significantly changed. There is a, not just the election results, but a deep-seated frustration by many senators on both sides with the way the Senate is working.
Well, I'm actually skeptical as to whether a deal by Reid and McConnell could ever restrain a zealot like Senator Rand Paul, the Libertarian, who has extremely didactic views. And he's done a lot of holes already. Unless you have a rule to stop him, I mean, do you think he's going to listen to McConnell?
Well, they don't get along, and they're even from the same state. So we'll see. I find that, to some extent, the leader and the support he has in his caucus puts a lot of pressure on people. In the past, McConnell, the last 4 years, used that pressure to pressure Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe and others to get on with his program. But I think that to the extent that he is leaning on people not to use individual holds and filibusters, I think it will have some effect. Look, the truth is, I would have gone further. I don't actually believe that individuals ought to be able to obstruct the Senate. I believe they ought to be able to have their say, but not obstruct things indefinitely. But I think we'll have to see how this plays out.
Well, not only obstruct things indefinitely, but also be able to obstruct things secretly.
Well, I think that part of what Reid and McConnell have said is that isn't going to happen. We'll put them to the test. Let's see if it happens that way.
So do you think then that there's anything that's going to happen that's going to clear the enormous backlog of appointments and particularly judicial appointments because they've been filibustered? This D.C. Circuit Court ruling foreclosing the president's option to get around the very roadblocks that the Republicans in the Senate have placed adds to my sense that our democracy is off the rails. So what do you think in terms of this deal? Are we going to see more Democratic judges, even moderate ones, which apparently is all that they put up nowadays, get a hearing?
I think that we will see more judges and more rapid consideration of judicial and executive nominations. I do think that the president needs to make, as you and I have discussed, I think the president needs to make this a priority. I don't think he pressed hard enough in the first term for having his judicial nominations considered as rapidly as previous presidents, and I think he has to make that a priority.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ira Shapiro.
Yeah, I hate sometimes to disappoint anyone by not being as pessimistic as, but I genuinely believe that the Senate has hit bottom and I think is poised to come back.
Well, I hope you're right, and I thank you, Ira Shapiro. Again,
we'll check on it in a few months.
Okay, Ira Shapiro, an international trade lawyer in Washington D.C., spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the Majority Leader and in other senior positions. He is the author of a new book, The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the UN's efforts to look into the use of drones and create a legal framework for their use.
Shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. Truth for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Rubenstein, who's a University Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 8 books, including When Jesus Became God and Aristotle's Children. His most recent book is Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Rubenstein.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And last week, the UN launched an inquiry into the impact on civilians of drone strikes and other targeted killing, talking about the exponential rise of drone technology requiring a proper legal framework to be put in place. How do you put the toothpaste back in the tube in terms of drones? Because obviously they're going to proliferate. And I believe at this point, 51 countries have them. Therefore, the U.S. has a temporary advantage, just as it did with the atomic bomb.
Yes. And the question that sort of looms over all of this is not just the technology, not just the fact that there's a new weapon, but what's the purpose of using it? How is it being used? What's the purpose of using it? And I'm afraid that one of the purposes of using the new weapon is to pursue military objectives in far-off places, to be sure. But it also has a political purpose, and that's to make this kind of warfare, make continued warfare on almost every continent, acceptable to American people, to make questions disappear. Questions like, what are we really doing over there? Whose interests are we protecting, or whose interests are we serving? And in addition to the question of how many innocent people are getting hurt because of collateral damage and so forth, there's the deeper question of whether we haven't developed a system of permanent warfare in which the executive branch, the president at his own discretion, kills whom he wants to kill, anywhere he wants to kill him. And there no questions are asked. No questions are asked by Congress. No questions are... Fortunately, there are now questions being asked by the people online and bloggers and so forth, and also by some Congress people. The Progressive Caucus in Congress is now starting to get itchy about this because it really begins to look as though, because these weapons are portrayed as being surgically accurate and because they're not involving a lot of body bags with American troops coming home, dead, and because sometimes the American actions are undertaken in conjunction with other powers, European powers, NATO powers, and so forth. This is a very alarming, in my view, a really very alarming shift, because it's really designed to make us stop worrying about war and peace and to just leave the war and peace questions to the government, to the military, and the president. This is really unhealthy in a democracy. So I'm glad that the UN is making waves, and I wish that we would make more waves about it here.
Well, of course, the irony is, given our earlier conversations in the program today about how the judiciary, the Republican-appointed judiciary, is moving to curtail presidential authority over recess appointments. And, of course, at the same time, they're only too happy to give the president unlimited authority in national security issues like targeted killing in Guantanamo.
That's right. I think that's true of many conservatives, although it's not true of, the Ron Paul wing of that movement. Is as concerned as the left is about this excessive presidential authority. But, it seems to me that the kind of bottom line here, that the whole debate is going to continue in a sort of, in a kind of hollow way, unless we start talking more substantively about what the United States is doing abroad with all of this military power and whether they have to be doing this, you know, the general feeling that's being sold to the people by the Obama administration as well as by many conservatives is that you're dealing with terrorists who are such bad guys, the jihadists and so forth, that you just have to kill them before they kill you. And if you find a more efficient way to do it, like a drone, why not, you know, why not use the drone? Which begs the whole question of what are the sources of these extreme Islamist movements? And is there any way to deal with them other than kill or be killed? I'm absolutely convinced that what we're dealing with is a complicated historical phenomenon that needs to be analyzed, and that on the basis of that kind of good analysis, we can find ways to try to deal with, you know, the basic needs of people who are acting out in a very vicious way. I mean, I'm not apologizing for jihadist, you know, violence. I think you have some people there who are bad guys, all right, but they're not bad guys because they're bad. They're bad guys because of the situation that makes good people act savage sometimes. So we need to analyze the situation and say, what is it? For example, lots of people in the Arab world and the Persian world are under the impression that the United States wants to make all the important decisions for them, and if not the United States, then Europe and the United States, that they have no power, that they're constantly being humiliated and made to feel powerless, and they're constantly having decisions on what to produce and what to buy and what kind of policies to have and so forth made for them by the West. Of course, that's true. You know, the United States and Europe decided to get rid of Gaddafi in Libya because they, a phony reason, they said they were afraid that he was going to kill all the, you know, kill the zillions of Libyan civilians. But if that had really been the reason for the intervention in Libya, then the intervention would have stopped as soon as Gaddafi turned back from Benghazi. Instead of which, you know, the U.S. and NATO forces followed him until they destroyed him. They wanted regime change. And they got the regime change. And then, as a result of blowback, as a result of the regime change, we now have Tuareg rebels who were formerly loyal to Gaddafi trying to overthrow the government of Mali. And now we, et cetera. We have Libyan jihadists attacking the oil installations in Algeria, et cetera. Or, you know, if you look at Syria and you say, here's a horribly difficult situation in Syria. You have a guy in power who is a dictator and who's brutal, but who had also represents a lot of the people in Syria, think he's okay, and had kept things together in that country. Then the U.S. and the U.S. allies start to arm this kind of ragtag opposition, which still has no political coherence and no political program, and they managed to create enough chaos in Syria so that millions of people are now refugees from Syria. I don't want to go on and on about this. I want to say two things about it. One, the United States and the Europeans can't seem to stop meddling in the Arab world. Two, when they do meddle, they make things worse. They don't solve problems with this kind of military, whether it's drones or conventional forces. You don't solve problems through military action. You solve problems through getting people together, sitting down with some good facilitation, finding out what's really on people's minds, why they're really pissed off, and then trying to restructure things so that they get what they want. You know, so that it's, you know, when we have an oil installation in Algeria attacked by jihadists, and all we can do is say, oh, those jihadists, aren't they terrible? We're not saying, wait a minute, who owns that oil? And why are we protecting the people who own the oil? And, you know, kind of what's it all about? Why are we over there in the first place? And why are we resorting to military actions when we could be doing all sorts of other things? We could be doing diplomacy. We could be doing talking. We could be doing problem solving in numbers of ways that have proven successful in lots of places around the world. And I think the answer is that there are people, there are interests in the U.S., in Europe, around the world, who want a permanent state of war, because that's the way they're protecting their financial interests. That's the way they're protecting their geopolitical interests. And they either don't have the imagination or they don't care that there are almost always alternatives to this kind of military activity.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Rubenstein, who's a university professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 8 books, including When Jesus Became God and Aristotle's Children. His most recent book is Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. Now, it's interesting, Richard, that you bring up the Sahel and Algeria, Libya and Mali and the current war there with the French intervention. I've had lately on the program, I had the former U.S. ambassador to Mali, Vicky Huddleston, making the argument that, in fact, because the U.S. has been preoccupied in Iraq and Afghanistan, it wasn't watching this area where the remnants of that hideous civil war in Algeria had moved into northern Mali. And then when Gaddafi fell, all those arms became available to them. And now we are suffering the blowback from our neglect in the region. And my impression was that what she was really arguing was that we should have been doing more drone activity and either targeting the jihadis or watching them or whatever. Because now, because we neglected it, they formed an army and they're heavily armed. And now, of course, they try to take over the country, requiring the French to intervene. So that seems to be the argument that we're getting from our national security community. And it's worth noting that the person who is apparently most responsible for increasing dramatically the drone program in the United States, John Brennan, is now going to be head of the CIA.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, it's sort of falling under the rubric, at least in some people, the way some people are looking at it, it's falling under the rubric of soft power. Soft power, smart power, you know, we're hearing a lot about that, which really amounts to translate that, it's imperialism light. It's imperialism without the costs that formerly had to be paid for imperialism. And what people don't seem to want to ask is there an alternative to imperialism? So it's not that Huddleston's position is unintelligent, you know. I mean, it's not stupid to say that what she said, but it's unimaginative. You know, it's wildly unimaginative because it suggests that the only thing you can do when you have this threat is, you know, meet it in a military way. So folks are not asking, well, are there policy issues? Are there policy moves that the United States and other great powers could make on the world stage that would basically make this problem become obsolete after a while? For example, if people in the North African region finally got the impression that they could actually make the decisions about how they wanted to live their lives, whether it's what kind of religion they wanted to practice, how their natural resources would be developed, what they wanted their international political stance to be, and so forth, and if they were encouraged to form a regional organization, this is my friend Johan Galtung, you know, the Norwegian peacemaker, is constantly talking about the need for regional organizations to empower people in regions that are not the West to make decisions about their own resources and their own destinies. You know, one of the main planks of the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and all of those organizations, one of the main planks, one of the main things they're selling is unity, They say to the people, look, we've been divided artificially by the Western powers. We'll offer you a chance to overcome these divisions of tribe and nationality and to have a united front, you know, against the West. Well, that's very appealing. I mean, if I was over there, just an ordinary person living over there, I might find that enormously appealing because I know that I'm living in a world that's been divided by outsiders and kept powerless by outsiders. And I know I'm being told it's no business of yours what we do with the oil here. That's our, we own it, we'll do what we want with it, etc. So the conversation that I think we need to have is about new models of world order. Richard Falk has been talking about this for years, and he's absolutely right, that the alternative to having a permanent state of war representing this, what I called imperialism light, drone imperialism instead of armies imperialism, is a model that's not imperialist, that gives regions around the world the right to make decisions for themselves. There are going to be a few people who own a lot of, you know, property or a lot of stock who aren't going to like that, or a lot of weapons that aren't going to like that, but it's time, I think, you know, the other thing that you have to say about this is that doesn't work. I mean, what if the United States had been paying more attention to the Sahel? Well, we paid an awful lot of attention to Afghanistan. So how did that work? How do you like the way Iraq worked out, where we paid a lot of attention? What if we had been paying more attention to the Sahel? So what? We would have done more military stuff, and the opposition would have gotten more militarily sophisticated. And every time you fly a drone over somebody's territory and people get killed, even if it's not collateral damage, you know, even if it's the people you wanted to kill, the people in that territory think, my God, we don't have any power and we don't have any honor here if they can do this to us. I mean, you just have to think for a minute how we would feel if somebody's flying drones over Kansas or, you know, or New York. And if the excuse, as they blew up somebody's car or building, and the excuse was, well, we killed a drug dealer, or we killed somebody that you'll agree to was you didn't like him either. We would say, we don't care whether it was a good guy or a bad guy. We just know that you're presuming to run things over here. And that's what we're mainly tired of. So I think the fact that you allow people with what I think is a vicious ideology in many ways, you know, the jihadist ideology, that you allow them to capture the sentiment of people around the world who really want autonomy, who want independence, want to make their own decisions. This is the real crime, it seems to me. This is what's really wrong with the drones and the rest of these, you know, sophisticated ways of fighting a war that we shouldn't fight the war. We should find out how to deliver to people what they most need, which is autonomy and dignity.
Well, I perhaps have misrepresented Ambassador Huddleston. She may not have entirely thought that it was all about targeting the jihadis before they grew into an army, and more about taking care of this incredibly impoverished country and helping it. But one of the things that did come up in the interview was we talked about Algeria and that the Algerians were dead against the U.S. intervention in Libya. And she said, well, probably for the right reason, because look what happened.
Yeah.
So this leads you to the broader question, which is, what do you do about the people like Milosevic, these, you know, criminals and genocidal people, and the Assad family, and the Gaddafi murderous kleptocracy? Because if your point is well taken, that the intervention ends up creating a whole new set of problems, but that's not to say that accommodating or coexisting with these hideous regimes is morally acceptable as well.
Right. It's sort of like asking the question, if you have a bad guy in the neighborhood, but there's no legal system to deal with him, what do you do? And then we could argue about, well, vigilantism, you know, might be the answer, but then vigilantism creates lots of problems because people all, you know, name themselves vigilantes and do what they want. In the case of the kind of the international bad guys, what's required is ultimately is an international system that's a real international system, not as kind of some institutions that are puppets of global capital and Western political interests, that would be in a position to say, we got some genocide starting over here, you know, we got to stop it. When you look around the world and you say, you ask the question, well, when did the great power stop genocides? When did they intervene and so forth? The answer is only when their own interests dictated it. They didn't do a thing in Rwanda. In fact, they probably the West made it worse in Rwanda because there was no money to be made by, put it frankly, by intervening there. So what's desperately needed is a legitimate system that would permit international intervention in case to save masses of innocent lives in situations in which they're endangered. And you don't have that kind of system. You have this picking and choosing system now in which, since Libya has oil, we go in and get rid of Gaddafi, but some other place doesn't have anything worth trading, so to hell with them. And also, because we know from, I talk in my book about this and Reasons to Kill about it, but we know that when powers like the United States intervene, even though they are sincere about their humanitarian reasons for intervening, as the U.S. was in Cuba, let's say, or in the Spanish-American War, they come as liberators and they end as occupiers and exploiters. In fact, they end up a kind of weird simulacrum of the bad guys that they had meant to replace, that they had said that they were replacing. So since that doesn't work, now you say, well, but we have emergencies now. We have Assad and so forth going on now, so we can't wait. And then my response to that would, yes, you do. You have to wait. I mean, until you have a legitimate system of intervention, if you're going to then say, you know, appoint yourself the savior of humanity to pick and choose which atrocities you're going to prevent around the world, that's worse. It's because what that does is deprive local people of the, you know, I often wonder, what if kind of current institutions had been in existence at the time of the American Civil War? I mean, could you see the headlines? Could you see the debate in the UN? Sherman marches on Atlanta. American generals are killing American civilians. Sherman burns Atlanta. You know, wouldn't you have an international intervention? Wouldn't you have NATO, you know, wouldn't you have drones over Atlanta to stop Sherman from marching to the sea?
Well, but you did have international intervention in the form of European powers happily to sell their arms to both sides.
Well, that's true. But, you know, the English, for a while, were
supporting
with
the
South. With all due respect, they were talking about intervening on the side of the Confederacy for a while because of the cotton trade.
Sure, sure. But, well, look, we've run out of time. You've made some very, very interesting points, and I wish we had more time, but unfortunately we don't, Richard Rubenstein, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Rubenstein, who's a university professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 8 books, including When Jesus Became God and Aristotle's Children. His most recent book is Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by half.